If Texas has its way, he'll be dead before midnight. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where final preparations are underway to execute Green by giving him a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage and commentary on the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions in the modern era. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorney Larry Douglas, Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Professor Dennis Longmire, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood, and special guest Professor Robert Perkinson, author of the book Texas Tough, The Rise of America's Prison Empire. The Execution Watch begins.
This is Execution Watch on radio station KPFT Houston. We are also broadcast on HD channel number 1. We're broadcast on executionwatch.org and kpft.org. Glad to have you in the audience. We're never happy when we do one of these shows. Johnson Green, there have been some last-minute flurry of activity in his case, and so we do not exactly, as we begin the program, know where we are with this, but we know somebody who does, and that is Professor Dennis Longmire of University, Sam Houston State University in Huntsville. Are you there, Dennis?
Yes, I am.
Anything going on there?
Nothing unusual, unfortunately. The most unusual thing is that I'm right now the only person here in opposition. There had been a young woman who is originally from the general community around where the crime took place, who was here. She's here. She and her family are somehow connected to the Christina's family, the victim.
Mm-hmm.
So the two of us are here talking about just the horror of the entire event. Everything leading up to the execution needs to be kept in mind right now.
Let me give the a visual to the listeners. What we're talking about, that's 12th Street, runs there in front of the walls in prison. It's an old unit built in the late 19th century. Texas short story writer did his time way back in his day. It's an old construction, and I'm getting a lot of variation in the tones, but I see an engineer's working on it. For there only to be two people means that street is pretty naked. How many guards have they got out there?
Actually, there are no guards at this point in time. There are four people here, all of whom work for the Office of the Inspector General. And so normally there would be at least one prison guard here. And the way the scene works is I'm literally standing underneath a stop sign.
Mm-hmm.
And that stop sign is the corner of 12th Street and Avenue I. And I'm literally looking to my east, and I can see a guard tower about 150 yards, 100 yards down. That guard tower looks straight down onto the roof of the execution chamber. There's a yellow police type of a tape that has the word caution on it that's tied to a do not enter sign. And they have this dance position there because there are people coming and going through that intersection, and he has to lift this yellow tape up high enough so the cars can get through. And while there are normally six or seven officers, tonight there is just one. And as I said, he is not even a correctional officer. He works for the Office of the Inspector General.
Well, did you get word earlier about some last-minute maneuvering in this case?
Well, I got very vague word that, of course, I heard that the Supreme Court rejected that the Fifth Circuit rejected the previous federal judge's decision,
mm-hmm.
which then turned the table back to Jonathan Green's attorneys, and they apparently have filed some kind of a petition to the Fifth Circuit again. This time they're filing a petition rather than the state filing their petition. And before coming to the corner, I called the Office of Public, the Public Information Office, and they said that at that time, this was just shortly before 5 o'clock, probably about 4:45, they said that Jonathan's attorneys had advised them that they were going to be submitting a petition to the Fifth Circuit, but they had not yet filed it.
Has any witnesses, the media, or any family witnesses crossed the road?
No, there has been no action like that at all. Of course, the family members of the victim would already be in the Walls unit waiting.
Yeah. They come in by a different route.
Yeah, there was a time when they would all come in. There would be three different groups that would cross the street. I call it the March of Witnesses. Probably 12, 15 years ago, for some reason, only two groups walk across.
The first
group are members of the media, and that's the only sign that we get that the execution is going forward, is when media witnesses cross the street.
Elizabeth, our producer, wishes to join the conversation. Elizabeth?
Hi, Dennis. Hi, Ray. Sure. I just want to let you know that I heard from the Supreme Court that they have turned down Jonathan Green's petition.
Okay. Well,
So then witnesses should be on the move relatively shortly.
Yes, very shortly, I would imagine.
Doesn't it depend on what happens with the newer petition with the Fifth Circuit, though?
My suspicion is what you heard is that the Fifth Circuit, that's when we say the Fifth Circuit, that's Justice Scalia. And so my suspicion is that means...
Well,
that
the Supreme Court would be Justice Scalia.
Well, Scalia referred it to the full court, though.
Yes. Yeah. He's the Justice of the Supreme Court who oversees all of these issues associated with appeals and stays for states that reside within the
Fifth Circuit,
the political boundaries of the Fifth Circuit. And Justice Scalia is renowned for rejecting petitions for stays. I can't remember all of the other figures, but from most of the other justices, when a petition comes before them, something around anywhere between 40% and 80% of those petitions are granted. And I think that in Justice Scalia's case, it's like 5%. So there's a significant difference in the success rate of petitions in his court.
Okay, Dennis, we are going to wander.
Okay.
And if anything happens, you know the number here, give us a call back.
I certainly will.
Okay. And that's Professor Dennis Longmire of Sam Houston State University. And Dennis is a remarkable person. He's a frequent vigilant out there to oppose capital punishment. And he's a professor there at the university where most of the guards go to study. Is Dave Atwood available? Do we have Dave yet? No, we don't have Dave. Dave Atwood, we will be in touch with him shortly. He is with the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. We saw him today at noon around the courthouse. Today is World Anti-Death Penalty Day. And a group of us gathered, my old friend Linda White and I rebonded and went to lunch afterwards with Elizabeth. And we were down in front of the criminal courthouse having a little vigil to point out that. Jonathan Green is from Montgomery County, is being executed on this, the World Anti-Death Penalty Day. Jim Skelton is an attorney, and he has looked into this incident. What say you about what happened?
Let me clarify, just kind of make things a little bit more simple. What had happened, 2 days ago, a federal judge here in town granted a stay of execution. The attorney general then appealed to the Fifth Circuit, and last night the Fifth Circuit removed the stay. And then from there, they went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and we just got word a second ago that Judge Scalia affirmed what the Fifth Circuit said.
So when Judge Scalia picks up the phone, that's just about what you expect.
Right. Here's basically what happened, Ray. It's not a complicated case. There was a young lady named Christina Neal. Lived in a little town called Dobbins, Texas, lived outside of Montgomery. She lived there with her two older sisters, with her father, Victor. And what happened one afternoon, Christina and one of her sisters went to visit some neighbors, and they two sisters got into an argument. Christina decided to walk home, did not show up at home that night. Initially, they thought she had run away because she had a history of running away before. They began to look for her, and throughout the following couple of days, they found items along the road that indicated something had happened. Her glasses had been smashed, found her billfolded backpack and things like that. As a process of trying to find her, they started interviewing various people. Well, Jonathan Green lived as a neighbor. He lived in the same neighborhood. He was one of the people they interviewed. They interviewed him initially. He said he knew nothing about the girl disappearing. Then a neighbor who lived next door, Jonathan Green, said the night the girl disappeared, there was a large bonfire on Green's property. The police go back the next day and ask consent to search, and he gave consent to search. And so what happened, they went to the area where the bonfire had been set, and they had a probe, and they started mashing it down and realized that there was probably what appeared to be a grave beneath the bonfire because the ground had been disturbed. So at that point, when they began to probe and started questioning Jonathan Green about the grave, he revoked his consent and told him to get off his property. Well, they did. They came back with a search warrant. When they came back, the ground, of course, the grave had been open at that time, and they came back with the cadaver dog. And what was the problem is, prior to going inside the house, Jonathan Green said something about some Mexicans set him up and hid the body in his house. They then go to the house and they find the body of the young girl, Christina. She had been strangled, sexually assaulted, and strangled to death. And that's basically pretty much the case.
That's the case. Let's see. Who is this? Dave Atwood?
Yes, I'm here.
There's been a little hitch in the come along. However, the latest word we have from Jason Clark is that there is no other pending effort on Green's part, and TDC is awaiting a conference call to confirm the Supreme Court of the United States ruling, and then this execution will proceed. No witnesses have crossed the road at this point.
Okay.
Dave, where are you?
Well, we're out at the corner of Holcomb and Alameda on the south side of Houston. This is one of the locations that we have our vigils at, our protests and our vigils. And we have, Ray, we have about, let's see, 6 or 7 people here right now. Not a big group, but some of these people were out for the press conference this morning for World Day. And we brought our World Day Against the Death Penalty banner with us, so we're flashing that out here. And you know, the good old faithful protesters against the death penalty are here.
Dennis Longmire reports that he's got an even sparser crowd in Huntsville.
Yeah, I think, you know, some of the people that were out this morning may be a little exhausted. They're tired, and I, you know, it's and I guess this case got only moderate coverage in the news, so it's not a really high-profile case. And of course, a lot of people thought it was called off. So that's probably one of the reasons. But we're out here. We've got our signs. We've got our banners. And we're making our statement.
Well, it was good to join you and Linda White on the on the podium this morning about World AIDS Day. I think it's unfortunate that Jonathan Green is being executed on this day of awareness.
I know. It's really, again, another sad statement for the state of Texas that they don't even recognize World Day Against the Death Penalty. They'll go ahead and execute somebody anytime, anywhere, basically. But you know, Ray, we just keep working at it. We'll keep protesting. We'll keep educating people. You know, we handed out, I think, about 150 flyers today in addition to our statements that we made for the press. And we just keep working at it. That's about all we can do at this point and not give up. It's a difficult subject for a lot of people. But as long as we show resolve on it, and I'm really convinced, because we see executions and death sentences dropping across the United States and across Texas, I'm really convinced that it's on its way out. It's just a question of when and how many more people are going to be sacrificed before it happens.
And Texas may well be behind the curve.
That's absolutely right, unfortunately.
Well, thank you very much, Dave. Give our regards to the other vigilants.
I will. Thanks, Ray.
Okay, bye-bye. That's Dave Atwood with the Coalition to Abolish Death Penalty. You can, Texas Coalition to Abolish Death Penalty. You can reach him at www.tcadp.org. www.tcadp.org. Dennis Longmire, who was on earlier, can be reached at www.shsu, Sam Houston State University, .edu. Go to their website, and he is easy to find. You can get in touch with folks if you care about these issues. Get networked in. We're waiting on a call with Robert Perkins, the author of Texas Tough, Rise of Americans, Prison Empire, where Robert was a frequent guest on the prison show and a visitor right here. He interviewed a good many of us. As he did his good work of coming up with a story. In the meantime, we're going to go over and talk to Larry Douglas. Larry, what happened in these trials?
Well, what I was going to just talk about is just the punishment phase of, okay. Of the trial. I mean, clearly, the
guilt or innocent didn't have much substance.
Well, Jonathan Green was found guilty.
Yeah.
Of capital murder.
Yeah.
So the punishment decision is life or death. And that punishment decision is made based on three special issues, whether it's a deliberate act, future dangerousness, and mitigation, particularly on the future dangerousness. Jonathan Green had never been to prison before. So there was no way to really know directly how he would behave in prison since he'd never been there before. So in order to get the death penalty on him, they introduced prior crimes and bad acts. And so some of the prior crimes and bad acts that they introduced against him was that, for instance, he was supposed to have committed a couple of misdemeanors. He also, there was evidence of a prior sexual assault. Now, it's not a conviction.
Not a conviction, but
just
some
evidence that he had committed prior sexual assault. Also said he'd stolen a pony from a petting zoo and had stabbed the pony to death. Also indicated that he, while in jail on this
awaiting trial
for capital murder, that he threatened a jail guard for taking some items away from him, that he robbed and beat another inmate, and that he threatened an inmate, said, "I'll make you stop breathing." And also that he got into an altercation with several guards, such that it took a violent encounter that required five or six officers to subdue him. So they introduced this evidence against him to show that he would be of danger, apparently, if he were given a life sentence. That's really the essence of the crime.
So the whole thing was based on the nature of this crime. And the behavior in county jails.
Primarily. I mean, the nature of this crime, I mean, they've got to show it's a deliberate act. They can pretty much show that since it was intentionally knowing, and the jury found him guilty of that. But the kind of punishment evidence that was introduced against him were the kind of things that I talked about just a minute ago.
We may revisit that discussion, but we've got Professor Dr. Robert Perkins, author. Robert, are you there?
I am. Nice to hear your voice, Ray.
It's nice to hear your voice. Thank you for joining us. Does Texas death penalty have any kind of unusual history?
It does. I mean, not as unusual maybe as it should be. It has both a long history and a more recent history, a kind of, the history of executions in Texas dates back to the founding of the Republic and before the establishment in the 19th century of the Huntsville Penitentiary. Death was a common penalty, and it was always in Texas in that deep history wrapped up with race. For instance, before the abolition of slavery, only whites and Mexicans were eligible for confinement legally in the penitentiary. Whereas the punishment for African Americans or slaves for similar crimes was only death. or, and in some cases, other punishments on the body. Death penalty was entwined with lynching in Texas for many decades, and in some ways the expansion of the death penalty and the centralization of it and the transfer to the electric chair in the early part of the 20th century was an effort to make the state a more effective instrument of death so that crowds wouldn't have to. And Texas, of course, has been very unique in the post-1976, post-Furman period, and having by far and away the most active death penalty, not the largest death row, but the most executing state, and Houston really is the epicenter of that in the modern industrialized world. There's no place in the modern industrialized world that compares to Harris County in terms of number of people put to death.
And in your research, in your book about Texas Tough, that book, which was pretty widely and affirmatively received, why did you pick Texas to illustrate the rise of prisons?
I was trying to figure out not just the death penalty, but the rise of severity in the U.S. criminal justice system compared to other similar democracies, and even more dramatically, the incredible increase in scale in imprisonment in the United States compared to other industrial democracies. For most of the 20th century, the U.S. incarcerated at about the same rate as similar countries. But from the late 1960s forward, first in Texas and other southern states, the rate of incarceration in the U.S. just really took off and, created the, and the U.S. now has the world's largest penal system, both in aggregate and per capita terms, such that we have, about 2.2 million people behind bars at any given moment. And we've really, as we've increased the warehousing of people, we've cut back on a lot of the rehabilitative programming, and it's become a more punitive, punishment-oriented rather than rehabilitation-oriented system, and the resurgence of the death penalty relates to that. I was trying to figure out why that took place, and my simple answer was that it was really entwined, didn't have to do as much with crime as we would think, and really had to do with the way that race still poisons our politics, and politics really affects our criminal justice system.
Well, and the question is, this is not working very well. Our incarceration. I mean, the people we send to prison far more frequently than not return for second trips and third trips. And a lot of folks, after imprisonment, kind of make a lifetime career returning to prison.
And it's really expensive. It's less expensive in Texas because guards make junk wages in Texas, but than in other states like California. But it's a really expensive solution to crime that has a lot of collateral damage and a lot of failure built into it, and yet it's become our solution of first resort.
And even though we are avidly and enthusiastically executing an awful lot of people, that doesn't seem to have much effect on the people subject to capital punishment.
Well, one of the things that I think is interesting about capital punishment in recent years, as the quality of defense in Texas and other states has improved. Texas has in some ways some of the weakest protections for capital defendants in the country, but it's a lot better counsel and access to appeals than other defendants have who weren't sentenced to death. And through the cumbersome, expensive, and exhaustive legal process that is undertaken in capital cases, it's a window into just how dysfunctional our criminal justice system is as a whole, because even in death penalty cases where you tend to have better criminal representation, lots of appeals, lots of attention, at least at the appellate stage, by really smart attorneys and judges who are paying attention, it's amazing the extent to which the people who are getting subject to the death penalty are not really the ones who committed the most heinous crimes. It's much more random than that. And sometimes as people commit horrid crimes, and this particular case we're talking about today is one of them that certainly raises the eyebrows and makes parents have nightmares at night. But there's tons of other cases that are similar to that in which no death penalty was imposed. And so it's really much more tied into, you know, the whims of the prosecutor, the quality of the defense, the inclinations of the judge, how many jury strikes were used. It's a troublingly random system rather than a system that produces fairness, which is one of the reasons why, you know, the death penalty isn't a good idea. And we've seen with DNA testing so many exonerations is that, our system is not nearly as effective at determining who is guilty and who isn't and who should go to prison for what amount of time as we might like to think.
Robert, since we have moved Execution Watch from the HD channel onto the main channel at radio station KPFT Houston, one of the things that has happened is when we come into the studio to do Execution Watch, it is being listened to with some interest by the guys on death row. There are women on death row, but they're beyond our broadcast signal.
Right.
But we have several dozen death row inmates who are listening either directly on KPFT's home signal or our repeater, which is located right across old Highway 59 from Polunsky. Do you have any encouragement to give those listeners?
I mean, I know some of the guys in there and have exchanged letters with them, and I've been to that tier at Polunsky, and it is a tough place. You know, and it didn't, I don't know if I have words of encouragement. I don't know that I could survive those sort of, that I would have the strength to survive those conditions myself. You know, just the isolation, especially the isolation, just that people are locked down for so long and have so little meaningful human communication, that psychologists think tends to induce a lot of depression and long sleeping and in some cases madness. So it's, real, I mean, the conditions you guys are enduring are some of the toughest that prisoners have ever endured psychologically, and the history of imprisonment dating back to the first prisons in the 18th century didn't always used to be like that, actually, when the death row was at Ellis, before George W. Bush, gearing up for the presidential campaign, moved it to Polunsky. Death row inmates, in reality, death row inmates are on death row a long time. You know, some of you guys listening probably have been there for 10, sometimes even 20 or more years. So there are lifetimes that are spent there, and previously they were able to work and do sports and make friends and say goodbye to their friends as they, it was their turn to be executed or when they got exonerated or their appeal got overturned. And, a lot of that has been turned back. It is awfully tough. I guess the only words of encouragement is that there are a lot of human rights organizations that are working hard to, demand that human beings, regardless of what they're convicted of doing, shouldn't for these protracted periods of time be treated like veal being fattened for slaughter.
Thank you very much for that. Robert Perkinson is talking to us from the University of Hawaii, where he is an instructor in American Studies. Someone said once that there are probably more Hawaiian inmates locked up in Texas than there are on the islands.
That was once true. It's no longer true. Now they're in Arizona.
Oh, they're in Arizona. They moved them. Okay.
But in the same way that in Texas, African Americans are incarcerated wildly disproportionately compared to Anglos and even to Mexicans in Texas. In Hawaii, the indigenous population, Native Hawaiians, equivalent of American Indians on the mainland, who tend to be going down most frequently for the longest sentences, and there's evidence that they're discriminated against. And a lot of those people, because incarceration in Hawaii is expensive, unlike in Texas, they get shipped out to non-union cheap land, kind of Walmart-style outsourced prisons. And at the moment, that's being run by Corrections Corporation of America in Arizona.
I find that very interesting. That wonders that mentioning incarcerating and executing Native Americans is that wonderful story about Injun Joe of Lincoln County, New Mexico. and carried him out to hang him. And they said, "Injun Joe, you got any last words?" And he said, "I thought I came out here for a hanging, not a talking." And so they proceeded. And that's part of the culture, too. Robert Perkins, thank you very much, not only for being on Execution Watch tonight, but your wonderful work at bringing some light down that dark tunnel with Texas Tough, Rise of American Prison Empire. Go to your favorite website or your bookstore and find out. How do people get in touch with you?
They can. I do have a website up, texastough.com. They can email me there. That's probably the easiest.
Okay.
They can just Google me on the web and email me too. I mean, I
would imagine
respond very quickly, but
I would imagine your good work means you Google rather well.
Yeah, I come up as you do, I'm sure too.
Thank you, Robert Perkins.
Okay, thank you, Ray.
Bye bye.
Good luck tonight.
Thank you.
My heart is. I'll be thinking about you all and about Jonathan and his family and victim's family too tonight.
Thank you, sir. That was Robert Perkins, an important man. He came down and snooped around and learned some stuff and turned it into a valuable work. TexasTough.com is how you get in touch. Well, we're waiting word from Huntsville for further progresses up there. What happens now? They may have gotten a late start on this execution, and so it takes longer to kill people now than it used to. So we may not have a definitive answer. I'll tell you where you can get the definitive answer is in the morning or in the middle of the night. You can go to the Houston Chronicle website and go to Houston Chronicle's website and read Grazik's column, because he's in there. If there's something going on in Huntsville, Grazik is in there, and he'll write about it. And that's an AP feed that the Chronicle picks up. Where are we on this case? I've lost where we were talking with Robert.
We were talking about the punishment hearing. One thing that I'm glad you mentioned, one of the things that's kind of skewed punishment hearings is the Larry O'Brien case from years ago. We've talked about that. And they had a big problem, they thought, with future dangerousness, because Larry O'Brien, as you know, is the one that killed his son.
Worst thing he'd ever done to be a Pentecostal.
And he had never even had a traffic ticket. And they were real concerned. They thought they were going to win it on future dangerousness, because he had, like I say, had done absolutely nothing. There's nothing that could say he did. But what the Court of Criminal Appeals did, a judge by the name of Davis wrote the opinion. They said a jury can take the facts of a case, and on those facts alone can prognosticate that he'd be a danger in the future. And that pretty well killed any hope of ever having insufficient evidence on future dangerousness, because truthfully, the reason we have the death penalty is revenge more than anything. And if you can use the facts of the case of guilt or innocence to determine future dangerousness, and it's pretty well all over, because in this case, again, the evidence on future danger is extremely skimpy.
Would the state admit that the function here is revenge?
They've never had it. And among lawyers, they'll admit it. But really, the only rationalization that anybody has ever come up with is it's just revenge. You've done an unconscionable act. For that unconscionable act, you're going to die. And that's revenge. You can couch it any way you want to. But the reason they killed Larry O'Brien, he was no danger of killing anybody else. He never harmed a fly. But he had killed his own son to collect insurance money to cover some theft he made from TSO. And they decided he committed an unconscionable act. For that, right, he was going to die. Had nothing to do at all with him being a danger in the future. That's nonsense, because he was no danger at all. And the likelihood of this guy probably being a future danger to the point that you have to execute him is very remote. But when they did the O'Brien case, we all pretty well said the ball game is over, because they can just use the facts of the case. A guy can be pristine, clean as the snow, as O'Brien was, and still say he's going to be a danger in the future. That's where the case really went off the skids in Texas.
Well, how dangerous are the people that don't get killed with executions and go to prison?
The recidivism rate for murderers is extremely low, about the lowest. I mean, it's almost nil. If a person is convicted of murder and then gets out of prison, they almost never commit another offense.
Well, is the dangerousness question academic? I mean, is it in there? Obviously, the legislature, when they put it in there, put it in there that they had a rationale for doing that.
Rationale is to get reelected again. I don't think it's
academic. Wait a minute. Don't rush through that.
You know, the thing is, nobody's ever run for office in Texas on liberalizing criminal law. No one's ever done that. They've all run for office based on the fact they want to put more people in prison and kill more people. All they've done, I don't think it's academic. I think it's simply window dressing. Because nobody wants to say we're going to kill somebody. They ask these foolish questions. And by the time they get to ask those foolish questions, they've convinced somebody of a horrible crime. They're going to kill them for revenge only. So to me, it's window dressing.
Our esteemed producer wishes words.
Right. I just got an email, actually, from the Attorney General's office. And they say they expect additional litigation in this case. So it has not been fully decided. My guess is that the attorney probably found other grounds to appeal on. I spoke with somebody from TDCJ, and he said he had just heard the same thing, that there's additional litigation pending, and he's not sure which court it's with, but he did confirm that, and everything is back on hold.
Everything is back on hold. So we may not have an execution tonight, but you understand they've got until midnight to do this. So at some point in that, if they get Scalia back on the phone, it's something's going to happen tonight. But fellers down on the row, the word is that Jonathan Green execution is currently on hold. We've been on the air for 36 minutes. No witnesses across the road. No processes have gone forward to advance this execution. We did not know that when we get on the air, and when we go on the air and something happens, a delay or a stay or something, we do the best we can to make a news story out of it. We were fortunate enough to have Robert Perkins call in. I'm glad he talked to you fellas up there on the row. For you free world people listening, I am extremely conscious that I have men who are waiting their own execution watch night coming up here. I would like to mention that on October the 18th, there's a scheduled execution for Anthony Haynes. And we, of course, want Anthony to get a stay. And then, actually, I will be on death row 1 week hence, because the following Wednesday, Hines is scheduled to get executed, and I will be doing an interview on death row with Hines. So if he is listening or if someone is listening that can get word to him, tell him that me and my crew will be there in the visit room on media day next Wednesday. For those free world people listening to this who are not familiar with this culture, and this is a whole culture, we do this every time someone is executed. And the reason we started doing this, someone was executed, is we felt that there wasn't enough emphasis on the grim business of executing people. We put together a crew of people. Usually Susan Ashley is with us. But that wonderful voice of Larry Douglas, which does our billboard up front and has joined the conversation here as an attorney. And Jim Skelton helps us. We depend on Dennis Longmire or someone else in Huntsville, and Dave Atwood somewhere on a picket line here in Houston to cover this. But we're doing this. Anything else about Jonathan Green we need to discuss?
Well, there's a very interesting human interest factor involved in this case, a twist, in that Jonathan Green and the current district attorney in Montgomery County, Brett Legone, actually went to high school together. They played football on the same high school team. In 1986, they were actually the championship team in their district. And they had a lot of contact with each other. In fact, the district attorney and Jonathan actually had the distinction of both having made, they were only two students who made the varsity squad their freshman year.
Wow.
Both of them did. Jonathan Green was the tailback. And the district attorney, Brett Legone, was the fullback. So he blocked for
Jonathan Green.
Jonathan Green. Jonathan Green apparently was a much better player, in that he was the All-State, player. It was such that they knew each other to the extent that when Jonathan Green made varsity his freshman year, his sophomore and junior year, he decided not to play at all.
Hmm.
Then he comes back his senior year and makes the team. Well, Brett Legone goes to him his sophomore and junior year, says, "No, you got to come back to the team." He says he wouldn't do it. And Brett says, so they knew each other to the point where the DA says, if Jonathan decides he's going to do something, he does it. If he decides he's not going to do something, he's not going to do it. Right. When he decides to run over somebody, he's going to run over him. That's just the kind of guy that he was.
Did the district attorney play any role in his trial, punishment? Or
Not in the trial.
This would be like a conflict 14. Of interest, yeah.
Well, this is the 14 years after.
He was elected only to be in office. This is his first
term. Okay. So his only responsibility, which is really the responsibility of the state attorney.
We'll see once.
Handling the appeal at this point.
All in the attorney general's
office.
The attorney general's office is
handling it now. Well, that is a strange set of circumstances.
Montgomery County is a fairly small county, and yeah. They've actually seen each other in the store. Since high school graduation, but it was a fairly interesting twist in that the two men did actually know one another. The lives went a little bit different, a lot different. In fact, Jonathan had a scholarship to play football in college, went to a junior college, and got injured. Mm-hmm. And he's indicated that that his life started to take a different turn. Now he was purportedly schizophrenic.
How old was he when all this happened?
34.
34. So he had finished his college football career. Apparently, he had done something right because he was a landowner.
Right.
He owned property there at Fort Bend. Not all of Fort Bend County property.
Montgomery County.
Not all of Montgomery County property is worthless. So he had bought some property there.
Several acres, I understand.
Yeah.
Something like 19 acres.
Do you know what he did professionally?
And all the stuff I read, there was nothing I could read that he did anything particular professionally.
Well, he made some money to buy property.
Well,
or maybe even inherited it.
Yeah. In that area, a lot of times you get it from family, too.
Sure.
One thing we probably haven't discussed that probably the current legal issue that's flapping around is one of these macabre, bizarre things. In Texas, you can be too crazy to die. And what they basically say is that in order, if you're insane, if you have a mental problem, so long as you're, number one, you realize that your death is imminent. You realize that. Mm-hmm. You're aware of it's imminent, and you're aware of the fact of why the state is killing you. If you pass those two tests, you're qualified to die. But if you're so delusional you don't know you're going to die, or if you're so delusional or crazy that you're unaware of the fact that why the state is killing you, you're too insane to die. And this is the big issue.
Wasn't their argument in Supreme Court just the last few days? I mean, they've just started the new session, but did they have something about these indefinite stays because of mental illness?
Not that I'm – mental illness is different than this. Mental illness is – when we talk about, there are several things. You can talk about a person being retarded, not eligible for execution, which is different than this. What they're basically saying is in order to be executed, you got to be sane.
You
got to
know – yeah, right.
You got to know they're going to kill you and know, be aware of the fact that why they're killing you. That's, if you can do those two things, you can have bats in your belfry but still be sane enough to be executed. And that's a big flap. What had happened, there's a case that came out in 1986 called the Ford case that sent these principles down. Once that came out, we codified it, that procedure, in the Court of Criminal Procedure. And then what happened is a case called Panetta that came out afterwards, and the big argument is, does Panetta change the Ford case? And all Panetta said, there's a difference in understanding and awareness. Because Panetta said, you got to be aware of the fact, not only understand it, but aware of that fact. And they also said that the evidence of a person being delusional is going to be admissible to make a determination whether or not a person is, in fact, too insane to be executed. And that's a big issue. That's what's currently pending in the Fifth Circuit. Because what happened, all this case, as you well know, was affirmed on direct appeal, then all the writs were denied. And then after they set an execution date, as soon as they set an execution date, they then filed a post-conviction writ saying that in the meantime, he was schizophrenic, hearing voices, was even doing things like sticking toilet paper in his ear to keep him hearing the voices, and that therefore he was insane and not qualified to be executed. So they filed another writ. They then had a hearing in the district court in which the state presented evidence from a psychiatrist and the defense defendant presented evidence from a psychiatrist. I don't know if this is a wise decision or not. I personally think it's not. But in the that hearing itself, they put the defendant on the stand. And that's always real dangerous because if you're crazy, you're not going to be a competent, good witness. And if you do a pretty good job testifying,
they're going to kill you.
They're going to be in big trouble. Well, who testified at that particular hearing was a college psychiatrist from the defense and one from the state. Of course, they said the opposite things. And then he testified and they had that hearing. And so what happened, the Court of Criminal Appeals claimed that the trial judge used the correct standard following the Ford case, the Panetta case. So they used the correct standard to determine that he, in fact, was sane enough to be executed. That's what has currently been on appeal, because what they argued in the Fifth Circuit was, in fact, that's what the judge granted the stay for here. She didn't, when the judge granted the stay here in town, she wasn't commenting on the fact that he was sane.
It didn't have anything to do with the original case. It was, is this man aware that he's about to be killed?
That's right. That's exactly right. And she granted the stay not on that theory, but whether she gave a stay of execution for them to be able to explore that particular theory. That's what the Fifth Circuit reversed yesterday or last night. And that's what Supreme Court has affirmed this recently. And again, I have no idea what the new issues may be, but the current issue kicking around was whether or not you're sane enough to be executed, which is kind of a bizarre thing when you think about it.
What happens when you go from district court to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals? I do know that Edith Jones has stepped down as the chief judge. Is she still on the court?
Yes, she's still on the court.
Still on the court. How many judges are involved in that?
Usually a three panel.
A three-judge
panel.
Right. And because it's an execution case, is there any priority given to how the judges are chosen?
No. They'll have what they'll do in particular terms. They'll set up different panels that'll work on cases throughout a period of time, and they'll seem to – depends on what panel you draw. It's kind of the luck of the draw. Unlike the Supreme Court, where Judge Scalia always hears the appeals from the Fifth Circuit.
Yeah.
But in this case, you have a three-judge panel, and it depends on what three judges you draw.
And the Fifth Circuit's got pretty checkered history.
Checkered, depending on which side of the fence you're on. They're considered very, very conservative. And the only one that's even more conservative is the Sixth Circuit. That's the only one that has the distinction of being the most conservative in the nation. And that's in the North Carolina region. But the Fifth Circuit's considered extremely oriented toward the state.
Well, I mean, Fifth Circuit is fascinating. When we were, before the Fifth Circuit, en banc, arguing Baker v. Wade, which was a challenge of Section 2106 of Penal Code. And Edith Jones grabbed the microphone, pulled it down, said, "Nothing is being said here today about the plot by homosexuals to take over this country." And everyone looked at one another and kind of paused. But it was true. Nothing was being said.
Of course not.
About a plot.
There wasn't a plot.
And so they just went on with the arguments.
That's true. The planet would be pink. I mean, come on.
And so she has been replaced by the first black presiding judge in the history of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals.
No. Clarence Thomas is black. So.
Yeah, I know. So that may not be as confusing. I'm getting a little more humor because apparently Jonathan Green, as of this moment, is out of immediate jeopardy. There has been a delay that has come on since we began doing this show, and that may actually hold. On the other hand, it may not actually hold. Because the window that Texas has to execute Jonathan Green begins at 6 p.m. on the scheduled date, and it does not close until midnight. Someone told me it effectively closes at 10 o'clock simply because of the nature of the operation of the courts. Don't count on it because the statute says midnight. Larry, is there anything we've left out? You've told us this interesting football story.
Well, I guess to just sort of piggyback on what Jim talked about, the hearing in which Jonathan Green testified. the court did find it interesting that the level of information he was able to testify to, that is, you know, he knew his execution date. He knew that he had a right to a counsel. He knew he had a right to a trial. He knew the names of the attorney. He knew the names of the judge. He had a vast amount of, upon cross-examination, he showed a vast amount of information about the underlying, facts and the procedure of the case. So that knowledge, I think, that testimony, I believe at that hearing was, as Jim mentioned, pretty
damning in his case. The record would be, could be used against him.
That was what the judge said she made her determination on, in terms of saying that I follow Panetta. I find that you are competent for execution based on your level of knowledge. You understand the connection between the, because he even contested his guilt. He says he proclaimed his innocence even. And the judge says, if you proclaim your innocence, it sort of suggests to me that you know a little bit more about the relatedness of the offense that you were convicted of and why you're being executed, which is critical for him to know in order to execute him, in order to find him competent for execution.
Well, you know, Winston Cochran, who handled some of these appeals, was in here shortly after one of his clients had been executed, and he said he visited with him. A guy spoke in kind of a word salad, never made any correct sentences, just a word salad. And at that time, the scrutiny level was perhaps a little different because some of these other cases, they had killed him anyway, and he couldn't construct a sentence.
There was a case in Florida. There was a real good book written about a lady that had worked with death penalty lawyers. And they had executed a man back in Florida years ago who didn't even know what death meant. In fact, he was eating. And when they took him to take him to the death chamber, he said, "Hold my sandwich. I'll be right back."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he was even unaware of the fact he's going to be executed. By the way, Ray, one thing I was going to mention, we have another visitor in the studio, a lawyer by the name of Jack Lee, who I've asked to come and join us. And it's interesting. I'd like to get some, like Jack to explain. He was born in Taiwan and he's been a member of the Chinese community here. And I would just curious about the Chinese attitude toward the death sentence, how they feel about the death penalty in China. Since Jack was born in Taiwan, I'm just be curious his perspective, because we talk about it a lot here in the United States, and I was curious about the perspective of the death penalty in China.
I think most Chinese folks China has been executed.
What did they say? Are they conservative or liberal about this?
Fairly conservative. As a community, we're going to be fairly, we're by and large going to be fairly
conservative. Let me ask you this.
Sure.
If you were picking a juror in a death penal case and had somebody that was Oriental from China as opposed to Vietnamese, would that be a plus or minus to pick that person as a juror if you're the defense lawyer?
Well, it depends. From an older generation, I would definitely try to keep them off of my jury. If it's from a younger generation, it might very well be a coin toss, because there are a lot of second and third and fourth generation Chinese and Asians generally who are fairly liberal. But as far as if you're a first generation in the United States, we have a tendency to be fairly conservative. China has had millennia tradition of capital punishment, and capital punishment is so common, and it has been so common in China in particular. That's the only history I'm familiar with, that it's not really seen as that big of a deal.
So there's no protest or things like that we have here in this country, or big long drawn out appeals, I take it.
No, the appeals in China probably don't last very long, and unless you are fairly well connected, it's probably not going to happen.
We had this famous case in China about the lady that had to deal with. They were accused of executing the British guy.
The one who poisoned a British businessman.
Yes, that's a recent case. Yeah,
yeah, the inside track of the story is that it's a political move, in part because of the expected upcoming regime change in group of folks who leadership transition that happens every 10 years in China, and that this may be a foil for what may for the leadership change.
Okay, Jim, you get any hot new information?
Yeah, I just got a little note from Elizabeth, and let me kind of explain this. So you have to understand this note. You kind of have to explain how it works. After you have a writ hearing, now let's talk about the writ hearing to determine whether or not he's sane enough to be executed, which is kind of a bizarre thing. Once you have a writ hearing, the judge is supposed to prepare, because the way it works is the judge that hears the writ just makes a recommendation. It's the appellate court that makes the decision whether to say he's insane or not insane. That's the appellate court's decision. And all the judge does is make findings of facts, conclusions mm-hmm. of law, and then he can make a recommendation. It's simply a recommendation. Now, what happened in this case, and it's done in virtually every writ, there's nothing unusual about it. Since the judge ruled in behalf of the state saying that, in fact, he was sane enough to be executed, the lawyers prepared, the district attorney's office prepared the findings and facts, conclusions of law. And what happened, they gave them to the trial judge a couple of days after the writ hearing. When they did that, Jonathan Gray's lawyers then filed a motion to recuse the trial judge, claiming that was an ex parte communication. In other words, it was communication with the judge without the defense lawyers uh-huh. being present. And so the new issue they brought up on the appeal is whether or not you can have a ex parte hearing with these trial judges after the writ hearing. Is that violate any due process provisions to permit the state and the judge to sit down after the hearing without the defense lawyer being present and decide what they believe is the finding of fact?
To go to the appellate court. Law.
Exactly. And that's a brand new issue they just kicked in the Fifth Circuit.
And so we are on procedure at this point.
Right, exactly. It's all a procedural deal at this point.
Well, I've been given the high sign. And that means, because in the radio business, the clock is God. And, so she has taken over and I must wrap this up. The execution of Jonathan Green is on delay. That may hold. It may not. We'll all find out before in the morning, because they've got until midnight to complete the process. We've been very honored to have, of course, our usual staff, Jim Skelton, Larry Douglas. I welcome the new attorney to the staff. You're welcome to him. And Jack Lee is welcome to come back in again. Dave Atwood reported from Houston. Dennis Longmire from Huntsville. Robert Perkinson, don't forget TexasTough.com. And our next scheduled execution is Anthony Haynes on the 18th. And our engineer tonight has been Doyle, and nothing would be possible without Elizabeth Stein. And my name is Ray Hill. This is Execution Watch, and listen to Victoria Panetti as we go out.
People of Texas, don't you know?